Session number 12778.
General Martin, Reel 15.
I left about, I think, in May 1963. And I was posted to Cyprus, to headquarters Cyprus District, as the AAN QMG, let's say the Chief Logistic and Personnel Officer for headquarters Cyprus District. When I was asked what sort of job I would like after the battalion, I said I would like, ideally, a good job in a nice place. If that wasn't possible, I'd rather have a good job in a bad place than a poor job in a good place. And I felt, really, I'd been given a not very exciting job in a very nice place. I went to see those people in the Ministry of Defence before departure, and I was briefed by the Quartermaster General's Department on a new car which was being sent out to the Commander Cyprus District, General Peter Young of the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. This was to be a Jaguar which was going to arrive in Cyprus very shortly. And it was a car which I was told General Young was very much looking forward to having. Well, I arrived out in Cyprus, and I found that there were two sovereign base areas, one at Decalia, at the eastern end of the island, which was where all the administrative troops of Cyprus District lived, RIMI, the RESC, Ordnance, and so on, who were responsible for a vast stockpile of vehicles and equipment, which had been placed there in the days when we were stationed in places like Aden, and which I think had been used for the Suez operation and reconstituted, and which was available should we ever have to go to war out in the Middle East. The commander of British forces lived in the other sovereign base area, which was 70 miles away, down at Episcopi. And there he was located alongside the headquarters of the Commander of British Forces, Cyprus, who at that time was Air Marshal Sir Dennis Barnett. And down at that end of the island was also the RAF airfield at Akrotiri. In addition to these various the two main sovereign base areas, there were also a number of reserved areas dotted all over Cyprus, such as a radar station on the top of Mount Olympus, Troodos, a British Forces broadcasting station, Nicosia, the RAF aerodrome at Nicosia, or an RAF station at Nicosia, and so on. I think the day after my arrival, I met General Young for the first time. I had been warned that he was a very austere person, and a fairly fierce one. And so I was looking forward to some trepidation. And we met at in the officers' mess at Decalia, and I found that he was a man of very few words. He didn't seem to talk very friendly. So I said to him, "Oh, by the way, sir, I was told to let you know that your new Jaguar car is going to arrive very shortly." And he said, I said, "I only hope that it is more reliable than the Jaguars in Germany." I said, whenever the Corps commander, for example, went down the Autobahn in his Jaguar, he was followed by a second Ford car to take him, pick him up when the Jaguar broke down. And He said nothing. I said, well, I said, Mefford, I brought my Jaguar out here to Cyprus, but that's forever breaking down too. He said, right, well, thanks very much for telling me that. When I was in the Quartermaster General Department, was responsible for ordering Jaguars for the army. I thought, oh, Christ. He was an extraordinary chap. He'd been taken prisoner at Arnhem and had decided that he would get away by posing as somebody who had lost his hearing completely and would be evacuated back to England by the Red Cross as being unfit for any further operations. And so he had to learn to behave like a deaf man. And this meant that you could, he might say to you, right now, brief me on this. And you would start to brief him. And after a time, you would realize that he was staring out of the window, puffing on the cigarette, which he always had in his mouth, but apparently entirely oblivious of what you were saying. So you would stop, and 2 minutes might pass by with no movement. And then he would suddenly turn to you and say, right, you were saying that, this and that. Carry on, don't stop. And on we would go. He told me later that he did get evacuated by the Red Cross. That his worst moment had come as he was having convinced everybody he was absolutely stone deaf by faking. As he was walking up the aircraft steps, one of the German, his German captors, suddenly shouted, "Young!" And he said it was the greatest feat in his life not to hesitate. But he got away with it and he got sent back to England. And I'm as the time went on, I became extremely fond of him. I thought he was a super person with amazing foresight. Things were very pleasant for the first 6 months I was there. I think I got there in beginning of July 1963, and one was able to get over all over the island. I was a member of the Island Water Committee. The water resources being not all that flourishing. We were in the middle of building a water desalinization plant to produce fresh water to make the Deucalia sovereign base area self-sufficient and therefore take some of the load off the Cyprus water, which was all contained in aquifers under the ground. I became quite knowledgeable on water in that time. And then things started to get a bit tricky. And suddenly, I think it was about the 21st of December, just as we were all preparing for Christmas, the Greek Cypriots suddenly turned on the Turkish Cypriots and attacked them. And General Young got agreement from the British government and the Cyprus government to try and intervene between the various fighting factions. We had in the garrison two battalions, the Rifle Brigade, which was at Deucalia, and the Gloucesters down at Episcopi. General Young was always very, I found very amusing about these two battalions. He, being a member of the Black Mafia himself, he was very pro-Rifle Brigade, and he enjoyed the their cheerful cockiness, so that if he went round their positions on an exercise, they would say, "Morning, General," and so on. Whereas the Gloucesters, being good, steady, old, heavy infantry, would salute and say, "Yes, sir," "No, sir." And so he instantly had a very high opinion of the Rifle Brigade and a low opinion of the Gloucesters. And I was always trying to make him understand that they were two completely different sorts of men who worked in a completely different sort of way, and they didn't mean that because the Gloucesters weren't chatty and cheery that they weren't just as good soldiers. And I didn't think I ever had real success there. He was a very emotional man, and when I think at some meeting in Nicosia he heard the news of a Turkish doctor who had got home to find his wife and children had been murdered and their bodies thrown in the bath. Tears poured down his face. And so that visiting firemen from England, and I think the Adjutant General was one of them, who came out to see what was going on, felt he was too emotional a person really to be in charge. But I think they were very wrong. I mentioned his foresight. He realized instantly that if trouble between Greeks and Turks went on, that it was an invitation to the Turks, a Turkish army from the mainland, to invade. And that if that happened, all our families who lived outside the sovereign base areas in the towns of Farmagista, Limassol, Larnaca and so on would be in grave danger. And that there would probably be mass influx of refugees from the Greek Cypriots into the sovereign base areas. And I was told to plan against all these eventualities. We first of all got cracking on building a new airfield built by the sappers inside the Tukena sovereign base area so that Hercules aeroplanes could land and take off with families, or to resupply as if necessary. We started to build a mole out into the sea, which landing craft or landing ship's tank could berth alongside, so we weren't any longer dependent entirely on Famagusta. We got the desalinization plant working flat out to produce us with water. We produced an operation called Orlok, which was the plan for bringing all the families into the sovereign base area, and each family from outside the sovereign base area was allocated to a family in married quarters inside the sovereign base areas, and got to know who they would be staying with if the balloon went up. We had all our 3-ton lorries equipped with special ladders so that old women and children could climb up at the back of the lorries and so on. And we practiced the scheme endlessly. We built up inside the supply depot vast quantities of food for refugees. I can remember Maggie soup being a principal ingredient. And we moved the British Forces broadcasting station from Nicosia, where it was right in the middle of an area with dead bodies all around it, down into its news station, which was in fact already practically finished down in Laconia, and merely needed a wireless aerial transmitter on the top of it, which we lowered into position from a helicopter with the aid of some parachute troops who were skilled high wire men, and got that going. out from England came Duncan Sands, who I suppose was Commonwealth Minister or something like that in those days. And he came out for discussions with Macarius and General Young, somebody who had to fetch Duncan Sands' briefcase from the car where he'd left it and bring it across into the office where he was having his meeting with Macarius, had a quick look inside the briefcase, which he thought was extremely heavy, and found it contained several cans of hair lacquer. Duncan Sands was a very smooth-looking character. And at that meeting, that particular meeting, agreement was reached with Macarius to divide Nicosia into two zones, the Turkish and Greek separate zone. And Duncan Sand wanted a coloured pencil to draw a line down the road, which was going to be the boundary between the two areas. The normal coloured pencil to draw boundaries is a black one. But General Young, the ADC, in his anxiety to get this black pencil out of the map case to hand it to Duncan Sands, broke the lead on it. And so Peter Young said, "Right, give him a green one," which was used, green being used for obstacles and minefields and things like that, marking map. So a green China graph pencil was handed to Duncan Sand, and hence the green line for Nicosia, and green lines all over the world ever since. One of the results of Duncan Sand's visit was that we were reinforced, and we were reinforced initially with Headquarters 16 Para Brigade, and I think two battalions, one parachute battalion, and a battalion of from another, I think from 3rd Division, the Inniskillings Fusiliers, commanded by a splendid character called Percy Blake. Fairly shortly after that, it was decided to bring Headquarters 3 Division out from England to take control of what was now becoming a rather difficult situation, so that General Young could concentrate on looking after the base and his family's and his own garrison and so on, while General Carver, who was now commanding 3rd Division, would be responsible for trying to keep Greek and Turkish Cypriots apart. So that was a slightly difficult position because you had two major generals there, whose areas of interest overlapped to some extent. And I found that I think General Young was a bit sensitive about General Carver's position. And General Carver had taken on board most of General Young's plans for keeping Greek and Turkish Cypriots apart. But I think he felt that it was a slightly difficult position. And I found myself to some extent being used as a message carrier from one headquarters to the other, trying to make sure that everything was done as diplomatically and uncontroversially as possible, and the relationships between the two headquarters were as good as they could be. Well, General Carver arrived out in February 1964, and it was then, fairly shortly afterwards, decided, because the Greek Cypriots were becoming very anti-British and thought this was just a British move to regain power over the whole of Cyprus again, it was decided to call in the United Nations. And out to Nicosia came an advance party of United Nations administrators. I had been told that we were going to have to look after the entire logistic support of this United Nations force, and that we were to bend over backwards to do everything we could to help it get established. And I went for a meeting with these UN administrators in Nicosia, and they cross-examined me about whether what our vehicles were like, which we could supply from the stockpile, what the whether we supply refrigerators for camps, whether our hospital was capable of carrying out eye operations, and what other sort of operation, dealing with wounds and so on. They went into great detail, and having got my answers, they then insisted on going round the Tekelia Sovereign Base area, examining the refrigerators which we had in the stockpile, examining the vehicles, going to the hospital, quizzing the doctors on who could do eye operations and so on. And in the middle of March, the first United Nations contingents started to arrive, and the very first one was the Canadians in the shape of the Van Doos. What we did was to establish camps for contingents to go into immediately they arrived. Most of them came in the middle of the night. So they came into a camp already equipped with tents, beds and bedding, cooking utensils and so on. And indeed we usually cooked our first meal for them to settle them in as quickly as possible. They were then, the following days, equipped with the vehicles they wanted and all the other items, I mean furniture for their tents or offices or whatever. And whatever it was that they required, and which we usually had somewhere in the stockpile. The Canadians were difficult in that, I suppose they were French Canadians, which made it slightly more difficult, but they were determined to show from the start that they were not, although they might be in the Commonwealth, they were nothing to do with the British. And so all the vehicles which were issued to them, as soon as they got them, they painted in different colours. This was before the days when everything was painted in white for a United Nations vehicle. So they put their own camouflage, etc. on. And they didn't really want to have more to do with us than they could possibly help. The Swedes and the Irish, who were the next lot in, they were veterans of the Congo, and reckoned they knew everything that there was to know about operations such as this, and didn't really want to take advice from us on anything. But we did our best, and we equipped the Swedes fully, and they went off to the north of the island, I think, or originally Farmagus and then north of the island. And they then sent one night there, or afternoon, evening, they sent a panic message to say that General Gianni, who was the United Nations general, Indian general, who had just taken over as from General Carver, with General Carver now as his chief of staff, was going to go and visit them the next day. And they had realized that their flagpole, which we had supplied them with, was too long in proportion to the size of their flag. Could we please make them another flagpole overnight and get it up to them? So instead we sent a chap up with a saw who cut off the offending 2 feet. And they were so impressed with this that thereafter they came to us for advice whenever they wanted it and help whenever they wanted it. The Irish arrived, and they were obviously extremely ill at ease with us. And these were the Free Irish, as we called them. initially, I think there was one battalion and then two. There was one slight problem in that the Inniskilling Fusiliers, who were still there, had quite a number of deserters from the Irish Army serving their ranks, and were quick to spot that quite a number of the soldiers of the Free Irish Battalion which arrived in contained deserters from the Inniskillings. So it was agreed to tacitly have a truce and forget about these things for the time being. I had a meeting with the sort of administrative head of the Irish contingent, a man in a rather dirty Panama hat, who was deeply suspicious of all this help which we were promising so lavishly. But having sort of got the message that we were out to help, then started to ask us whether he could have a few more blankets under the counter, whether he could have some ground sheets under the counter, because they had not thought to bring anything, any provision against rain. Then whether we could perhaps slip him a few Bren guns under the counter. Well, we drew the line at that one. But during the course of the time I was there, the next year really, it was interesting to see how we gradually got to know and I think got the mutual trust of the Irish. I was a bit annoyed to start with. We had gone to a great deal of trouble to make them a camp in Famagusta. The engineers had spent enormous trouble building huts and things for them before they arrived. When they then promptly named it, a great big notice board outside, Wolftone Camp, Wolftone having been a prominent Irish terrorist some time back. But we felt we had our own back, because just outside the gates, main gate of this camp, was a cafe owned by an old lady who had long provided refreshments for the Royal Engineers who had been lived in the camp before. And she was distressed when the commandant of the Irish Battalion put this cafe out of bounds. So every day she came to him with a bunch of flowers and begged him to allow her cafe to be put in bounds. And eventually he agreed, and she put up a great notice outside her cafe, in bounds to Her Majesty's forces. So that was we felt was a tit for tat. In fact, before I left Cyprus, we had the two Free Irish Battalions with us, and they were being moved from the Famagusta area, which was quite close to us, to a distant part of the island, and I had a final conference with their quartermasters,